Welcome to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising. Our show this week is really important. Our nation is at a turning point to positive, long-needed change, and we have tips for you on how to move our nation forward, lift our families, and make big transformational change. We cover how to increase the minimum wage. We need to increase the minimum wage. We cover how to save our democracy. Yes, we need to do that too. We cover how to get universal paid leave and to move forward youth and family justice. We're going to jump right in with our first guest. We are joined right now by a wonderful, amazing, spectacular, world-changing, nation-lifting Wonder Woman, Saru Jeyaraman. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Kristen. Great to be with you.
Now, you are president of One Fair Wage and an award-winning author and many, many, many other titles. And so I want to bring that forward because Saru has created such a spectacular movement to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and get rid of, obliterate, completely put an end to the unfair tipped minimum wage, which, by the way, right now, is $2.13 an hour. Yes, at $2.13 an hour. So I want to just have a moment to say thank you to from every listener, from every Moms Rising member, from every person in the United States of America for really leading this fight forward. And I would love to get your marching orders about what every listener, what every member of Moms Rising, what all of us should do to back up this really, really, really critically important campaign for our families, for our economy, for our businesses, and for our country. So thank you. And okay, what should we be doing?
We need everybody's help to call Congress, most of all, and tell them that the time has come to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers. As you kind of alluded to, Kristen, this is actually a direct legacy of slavery. You know, there was a time in the United States history, actually until 1853, when waiters in the US were mostly guys, mostly white men, and they got a full wage. And in fact, in 1853, they went on strike for higher wages all across the Eastern seaboard. And in response, the restaurant industry wanted to find a way to replace them. They didn't want to give them higher wages. So first they replaced them with women. And then at emancipation, they said, oh, well, we could find a way to replace them with Black people, mostly Black women, and not pay them at all. Let's use this newfangled idea of tipping, which had just come from Europe at the time, and say, we don't have to pay you a wage, just go work for tips. In fact, in some cases around that time, they would charge Black people for the privilege of working in a position where they could get white people's tips. So that became law in 1938 as part of the New Deal. Everybody got the right to the minimum wage for the first time at the federal level, except for millions of Black workers. Domestic workers were mostly Black, farm workers were mostly Black, and tipped restaurant workers who were told you get a $0 wage as long as tips bring you to the full minimum wage. And we went from zero in 1938 all the way up to $2.13 an hour today. And today, 70% of tipped workers are women in the US. They're mostly waitresses working in really casual restaurants across America. And as I'm sure we can get into it right now, they already experienced the highest rates of poverty and sexual harassment of any industry prior to the pandemic. But during the pandemic, it just got so much worse for these women. And so that's why everybody's got to tell Congress enough is enough. It's been 150 years in coming. Women have put up with this for long enough. It's time. There's a story of a woman in the 60s, a Black woman named Hattie. True story. She worked in a restaurant, and a white man came in, and he felt she didn't bring the drink fast enough, and he beat her to death with his cane. And I just think of that story when I think of the generations of women and women of color who've put up with this absurd, ridiculous $2, $1, $0 wage. In most states in the US, it's still under $5 an hour because the restaurant lobby wants to get away with not paying its own workers and force us as customers to pay these women's wages for them. And that's why all of us have got to say enough is enough.
Enough is enough. And right now we're in this moment where the cracks in our systems have been made all the more clear as the catastrophes that they really are due to the pandemic, where the data is in. And we've seen that women and moms, particularly women and moms of color, are experiencing compounded harms. And so we're looking at women and moms, and particularly women and moms of colors, being pushed out of the labor force in record numbers because we aren't earning enough wages to keep our families afloat. We can't cover childcare. We don't have access to childcare. It's all linked up together. And so now we're starting to hear restaurants and other places complain, oh, I can't get enough workers. Well, if restaurants and other places cannot pay people enough to be able to afford childcare, enough to be able to afford putting food on the table, enough to be able to afford getting kids' shoes as their feet grow, and they grow quite quickly, then it's actually, you know, a completely untenable situation. And then I also want to roll back into, this isn't just the right thing to do. This is the economically smart thing to do. Women and moms make the majority of consumer purchasing decisions in an economy where 72% of our GDP is based on consumer spending. So if we aren't paying people fairly for the work that they are doing, we are undercutting our entire economy, all of our families, and it is a lose-lose situation. And when we talk about, I have many things to say, as you know, we've been friends for a long time, but one of the things that comes up is people say, you know, women were pushed out of the labor force. Oh, well, actually women were 50% of the labor force for the first time in history prior to the pandemic. And those are much needed jobs. Women and moms are the primary breadwinner in 3/4 of families. So these jobs are needed jobs. These jobs aren't, you know, kind of side spending jobs, needed jobs. So I wanted to get your take on all of that because I know we're on the same page, but you always have a better way to explain it.
Well, no, I mean, Kristen, honestly, I feel like the restaurant industry is so the perfect example for you to use to say, no, we can't say, oh, well, that women left the economy. The restaurant industry is the perfect example of, if you don't take care of women, we all are going to suffer, because now we're not going to be able to eat out in the way we did because we didn't address this issue that affected women. So listen, with the pandemic, 6 million restaurant workers lost their jobs, overwhelmingly women. 63% that lost their jobs last March couldn't get unemployment insurance because in most states they were told your subminimum wage of $2 or $3 or $4 is too low to qualify for benefits. And that was a big lightning bulb moment for millions of women and workers across the country, because they said, wait a second, if the government's telling me I'm earning too little to get unemployment insurance, probably I'm earning too little. And so I find it hilarious that right now they're saying, oh, there's a new labor shortage and these workers are staying home collecting unemployment insurance, and that's why they're not coming to work. They never got unemployment insurance, number one. Number two, they left last year. They left last year when they realized they were totally undervalued. And listen, a lot of workers did go back to work last summer when they couldn't get benefits, because remember, there was some outdoor dining and stuff happening during the pandemic last summer. Millions of workers went back to work. They found tips are down 50 to 75%. And sexual harassment, which was already the highest in our industry of any industry, and customer hostility and health risks were way up. CDC named restaurants the most dangerous place to be, and UCSF top medical school named restaurants the most dangerous place to work above hospitals. And so millions of women said, wait a second, the tips are down, the hostility and health risks and harassment are way up. Hundreds of women reported that they were consistently asked, take off your mask so I can see how cute you are before I decide how much to tip you. We called it masculine harassment. And they're like, this isn't worth it. This is not worth it. Why would I expose myself and my children and my family to the virus for a $2, $3 wage when tips are so low? Like you said, they were like, I can't afford it. I can't cover transportation and childcare because when I get to work, the wages and tips are so low, they don't cover the cost of getting to work. So half of the industry left last year. What's happening right now is that governors are letting restaurants reopen. They're finding they don't have enough people. They're reopening understaffed. And the workers who are left are walking off the job saying, you don't pay me enough to do the jobs of 2 and 3 people and to put up with this level of customer hostility, which is only going to get worse this summer, as everybody wants to go back to eat, people are vaccinated. People are going to be angry that people, their food isn't coming fast enough because they don't have enough workers, and more people are going to walk off the job. So to me, this is the perfect epitome example of what you said. We can't say, oh, well, women left. What happens when women left the restaurant industry? We actually can't go out to eat. Half of the workers leaving the industry, I'm going to tell you, Kristen, means half the Sunday brunches, half the Friday night date nights, half the family dinners, half the business meetings at restaurants. We're going to shrink the industry in half or pay these women what they actually need and deserve.
And we need to pay people what they need and deserve now. I mean, now. So $15 minimum wage for everyone. Everyone, get rid of the tip minimum wage. We need to eradicate it, erase it, obliterate it, gone. And I can't even, $2.13, people, $2.13 an hour in 2021. No.
And we have 8 senators in particular we really need you to talk to, because they're Democrats who voted against this so far. We're hoping they're going to change their mind. But besides Sinema and Manchin, who I'm sure people can guess, Tester in Montana, Carper and Coons in Delaware, Shaheen and Hassan in New Hampshire, and King in Maine are all folks we need to call and say, listen, we know you care about people, you care about workers, in you got to raise the minimum wage, and you have to end the sub minimum wage for tipped workers. It's just too long overdue. A lot of these folks have been so worried about, can restaurants afford to make this work? Will they suffer? Will they fail? It's a pandemic. And what you said earlier, you got to listen to. There are 7 states that got rid of the sub-minimum wage decades ago. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all require full minimum wage with tips on top. There's higher restaurant industry sales and job growth, lower sexual harassment, higher small business growth in those states. Everything is better precisely for what you said. Customer spending is up in those states. The restaurant industry is thriving because customer spending is up. And so we need the rest of the country to follow those 7 states and just end the sub minimum wage now.
100%. I mean, what people forget is, again, consumer fueled economy. That means workers, people who are currently earning the minimum wage, are the consumers in our economy. And so if people are paid ridiculously low wages, then we cannot support and fuel the economy. So we've seen again and again, as Saru just said, in the jurisdictions and the states that have passed one fair wage and increased the minimum wage, that it actually stimulates the economy. It's not in any way, shape, or form hurting the economy. And so it is critically important. So everybody, I want you to make a commitment right now to do 2 things. 1, call your 2 US senators once a week until we pass this and say, hello, we need one fair wage. Get rid of the tip minimum wage, and we need $15 an hour. So one fair wage, $15 an hour for everyone, no tip minimum wage. It's super easy to remember. And I bet you have a website that
I do. Just go to onefairwage, onefairwage.org, and you can click there on call your legislator, and it'll help you call your legislator and send a letter.
The second job that we have for everyone is a little bit harder. Think about, do you know anyone in New Hampshire? Do you know anyone in Montana? Do you know anyone in, I'm trying to think of where the other 8 states, Maine.
Yes,
Maine.
West Virginia, Arizona, and and Delaware.
There you go. You know anybody in any of those states? And then call them and tell them to call their U.S. senators 10 times a week.
That's right.
If you live in one of those states and you're listening, call 10 times a week.
But I do think, listen, Senator Hassan is up for re-election next year. So I think her hearing from women across the country is perfectly okay. I think everybody could call Senator Hassan in New Hampshire and say, women across the country need you to do this. It's important for women across the country. So I think even if you don't live in New Hampshire, that's one that you can call.
Okay, that's good. That's good. So we are so thankful that you are on, that you're leading our nation forward. And I want to give the website again, because people should also stay involved. This is really important. We have, because of the leadership of Saru, move the ball down the field. We can see the finish line, but we have to pump up the volume. We have to do that extra last push. We've got to, call every day. And, so how can they get involved?
So if you go to onefairwage.org, you can do a couple different things. You can support, you can call your legislator, you can volunteer, sign up and volunteer and do more, help us get other people to call their legislators. We're also making a big announcement next week where we're going to be creating a way that you can directly support these workers who are thinking about walking off the job or walking off the job. So stay tuned. Look at our website next week for that big announcement, because a lot of these workers are struggling to make ends meet, feed their kids, and they're all women. And what we need them to do, it's so understandable, like you were saying, like at some point you just can't afford to work in this industry, you're going to leave. But we need them to stay and fight. We need them to stay in this sector and fight. And we want them to. They're professionals. They want to enjoy their professional skills, and we want to enjoy their professional skills too. So we need to support them to stay and fight. So go to our website, check it out. Please join the fight. Thank you.
Support. Thank you. Thank you, Saru, for everything. Thanks for being on the show. Thank you,
Kristen.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. We'll be right back with our next guest who's going to tell you, yes, you, how to save democracy. We'll be back in a quick flash. We're going to fight for love. With me, Kristen Rauffing-Feiner, powered by Moms Rising. We have a really, 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 really great guest for you right now. She is spectacular, moving mountains, changing the nation. Rhea Thompson Washington with the Center for Popular Democracy and the Declaration for American Democracy Coalition. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled that you're on because you are literally saving democracy. Thank you in advance, because there's some great legislation potentially moving in Congress right now, the For the People Act. And we need the For the People Act to move forward. It's in front of the U.S. Senate right now. What's in it and why is it important? Why should everybody give it a giant, big, enormous hug right now?
I mean, the For the People Act is important in this particular moment because it has it's a huge omnibus piece of legislation that can tackle so many things that we need, like automatic voter registration, like making sure that people are able to participate in the process of redistricting that is going to determine how many resources pour into our communities over the next 10 years. Also just reforming the current system and pushing back on some of the laws that were passed after the last election cycle that really are trying to temper the voting rights, are trying to suppress the vote. And so we are working to pass the For the People Act because we need automatic voter registration in the states. People should not be a question about whether you're able to vote. We need absentee ballots across the states. People should be able to vote as many ways as they can. And what we learned from the pandemic is that if states do the right thing, they can empower more people to vote, not less.
I mean, more people voting is optimal, I would think. And I am time and time and time and time again shocked by some of the Republican voter suppression. I mean, we have situations where there are laws being passed that you may not give somebody a glass of water as they are standing in line to vote. And mind you, the lines to vote are long because there has been insufficient investment in democracy in the first place, and people are closing places for people to vote. It is horrifying. I feel like the push for voter suppression has significantly increased in recent years. Do you feel the same way, or do you think this is more of the same, just with a different frame?
I think it's both and. In some ways, voter suppression has taken on a new look, right? In some ways, it's the same old things that have just been dressed up. And now we're having the opportunity to redress them because we know what to look for. So in some cases, like for example, a poll tax that has been outlawed looks like requiring somebody to buy a stamp to be able to mail their ballot back to the post office, right? When technically the post office should see that it's a ballot, it comes from the state, and automatically, you know, not charge any postage for that. And that's another way that it seems so slight, but people are having their vote not being able to be cast because they don't have access to things like stamps. And so, we want to try and attack all of the ways that we see subversive voter suppression happening, but also very blatant.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of structural racism inherent in the laws that are being passed at the state level right now that are aimed specifically at ending people's ability to vote. Do you want to speak to that and how that impacts our whole country and specific communities as well?
Absolutely. So what happened in Georgia is a perfect example. Georgia has automatic voter registration in some cases if you register to vote. Georgia has absentee ballots. They have, for the last election cycle, they allowed people to be able to vote at ballot locations where they can just drop their ballot off at an authorized ballot box. And all of those things have been rolled back specifically because of the amount of people that came out to participate in the voting that happened in 2020 and 2021. We also know that when we empower people with more ways to vote, that people will participate in the process. Some states have online voting. All states should have access to online voting. Some states have online voter registration. All states should have online voter registration. We should literally do everything we can to make it easier because we know that when we put barriers in the way, people who are actually trying to vote actually end up not being able to cast their ballot for a number of reasons, right? We saw when there's confusion around what voter registration, what days people can vote, whether on Sunday or Saturday or after work or during the day. We know that that is something that people are not always clear about because it's intentionally confusing. So we want to make sure and eliminate all barriers to the ballot box, period, so that everyone who wants to and who's able to can cast the ballot.
So, so, so important. People, tell your U.S. senators, because it's in the Senate right now, SR1, and it's number one for a reason. Mm-hmm. Our democracy needs to be upheld in order for us to continue as a functioning country. I mean, this is actually quite a dire situation because we do have such tremendously awful and damaging and very bad laws that are moving forward at the state level. And they're not moving forward to protect our democracy. I just want to be specific and really, really clear. There is zero pattern of voting abuse. Zero mm-hmm. pattern of voting abuse. In fact, many people, including people like me at Moms Rising, and I'm sure you, do a lot of efforts to get people to vote.
Right. Absolutely.
We have a ton of problem reminding people to vote, helping to open avenues for people to vote, you know, like making sure people have the time to be able to go out to vote, know where they can vote, all of that. Like the work that we do in our democracy is very much centered around how to help get people to vote. And there is zero pattern of people overvoting or, you know, having voter fraud. There is none of that. That is not happening. And that is not happening from a numerous amount of research studies. It's not just me who's saying it's not happening. It is just not happening. So what we're seeing here, when we're seeing these horrible voter suppression laws happening, is actually voter suppression and an assault on our democracy. We have to name it for what it is. It's an absolute assault on our democracy. And you know, it's so disappointing. Can I just say it's so disappointing? So what can people right now, if they could do one thing to help save our democracy, what should they be doing?
If there was one thing people could do to help save the democracy, they should be reaching out to their members of Congress. And there's so many ways that they can do that. For example, DFAD has a number of events coming up next week where people can participate in person if they're in and around the District of Columbia or virtually across the country to make sure that they are participating in this democracy, letting their voices be heard, letting senators know that they support the For the People Act, letting people know that they want to be able to have automatic voter registration, letting people know that they think that voting should be have an election day, which would, you know, provide more access again for people to be able to vote. So they can contact their senators. We have some, I can share with you our Mobilize link that you can share with their listeners. People can get involved. They should get involved. And we have to do something in order to make sure that we can pass this legislation.
What website should they go to?
They can go to www.declarationforamericandemocracy.org and for Declaration for American Democracy and signed up for all of the events that are happening over the next few weeks, but also over the summer, and making sure that the For the People Act gets passed.
Now, one of the things that we often hear from people is like, maybe my voice doesn't matter or what I do won't have an impact. Can you share with us what brings you hope that voices being raised does have an impact?
Yeah, what brings me hope is that I am one person myself, and I was organized by somebody who told me that I had an impact. And here I am nearly 20 years later, still trying to make sure that my little impact is enough to help somebody else make their little impact. And together, all of our little impacts will amount to one big impact. And yeah, so that's where we're at. That's my hope. That's what keeps me going. And it's and the website is dfadcoalition.org. Sorry, dfadcoalition.org.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you. dfadcoalition.org. That's Everybody correct. Go there, sign up, get the alerts, and then follow the directions and the alerts, please, because our democracy is important. It's so important. And we need to move toward a democracy where our contributions and our needs of everybody in the United States of America is actually reflected in our democracy, including in who we elect to public office. That is not the case yet. We have a tremendous amount of work to do. Not only do we have a tremendous amount of work to do in order to make sure that we protect our rights to vote and we end structural racism in voter suppression practices, but also to make sure that, you know, who we elect to the United States Congress reflects and mirrors who we are as a country. And we all do better when that is the case, because then we have better policy, we have better outcomes, we just all rise together. So we really want to protect the democracy. So I'm hoping everybody goes to the website. I'm hoping everybody calls their US Senator about SR1. You might notice a pattern. Things are getting stuck a lot in the US Senate. We've got clear leadership in the US House with Democrats leading the way. The US Senate, it's a little bit closer and we have a giant filibuster problem. So that means we need everybody to double, triple down on change. And do you have advice on the doubling, tripling down on change?
I do. At this moment in time, we are at a unique time in history where all of these opportunities, where when we were younger, we would say, oh, if I lived during the time of civil rights, I would have done X, Y, and Z. We're living during those times right now. And what people can do is get involved. Believe that not just your voice, but the voice of you, your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your community, people who you work with, all of our voices together are going to make an impact and make a change. And that's our triple down, right? So don't just stop at a call, tweet them. Don't just stop at a call and a tweet, tweet, email, and call them. Have your friends, have a call-a-thon with your friends. Just sit down and call people in your phone book. It doesn't have to be difficult, and it doesn't have to be super intrusive. And just let people know you're calling for you, you're calling for them, you're calling for your future.
And our nation's future too. I mean, really, the future of our country's democracy likely depends on SR1 passing, not to be over dramatic or anything, but these state laws are ridiculously damaging. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. We cannot rely on the states for this type of what we need, this sweeping legislation that we need right now. We need to make it come directly from the federal government so that it is something that is guaranteed and that we don't have to argue and go back and forth with states and sue states for the rights that we should have guaranteed to us.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm wondering, in the last bit, do you have a timeline on when you think this might move?
Ooh, Well, yes and no. So the first vote we expect to be next week. It could be the 24th. It could be the 22nd. But we expect it to be we expect the first vote to be next week. And from that, we hope that the filibuster, frankly, isn't used, so that we can have an opportunity to have this actually come to a vote and have some debate and come out with the best bill possible. And that is, you know, with all of the provisions that is already included in it. So we want to just try to make sure that we get folks, get them voting next week to move forward in discussing and debating the bill itself.
Well, thank you so much for being on. Everyone, call your U.S. senators, tweet at them, Facebook them, SR1 now, Save Our Democracy. Thank you so much for being on. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Don't go away. We're going to take a quick break. But next up, we're talking about how it's a paid leave summer, or at least how you can make it one. We'll be back in just a minute. We're going to fight for love. Breaking Through with me, Kristen Ralph Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising. We are joined right now by the amazing, spectacular, wonderful, world-changing Dawn Hucklebridge. She is leading Paid Leave for All. And by for all, we mean for everyone. What's happening? What's going on? And welcome.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for having me. And all of those lovely, flattering statements right back at you. Yes, so there's a lot going on. We are in a week of action. I feel like every week is a week of action, but this is a particularly big week of action for Paid Leave for All. We organized virtual lobby days. We are meeting with Republicans and Democrats in both chambers of Congress. And we had a virtual rally with a number of members of Congress, with COVID survivors, with veterans, with cancer survivors, with all kinds of different advocates and working families. And the whole theme being that this is a moment to do something meaningful after what we've all survived. And through the things that we survive in each of our own lives, pandemics or not, but the theme being that paid leave is about survival and resilience and growth. And that is human, economic, however you want to kind of extrapolate that. This needs to be the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's where we are. Yeah.
We're also part of the CARE infrastructure. So complicated things are happening in the U.S. Congress right now with a lot moving. We've had a change in who is in the Oval Office. We've had a change in what's happening in the U.S. Senate in terms of leadership, but we also have this ridiculous filibuster blockage problem in the U.S. Senate. And we have tremendous leadership in the U.S. House. And so a CARE infrastructure for the first time in history is being talked about as basic national infrastructure, that just like we need to build bridges and roads to be able to drive on to go to work, we need to build a care infrastructure, including paid leave for everyone, including universal childcare, including home and community-based care and services for people who are aging and who are disabled, including living wages for all care workers and all workers, including a path to citizenship for people as well. Now, where does paid leave fit in that for people who are just now thinking care infrastructure? I've not heard about that before. Care economy is another thing that we're talking about. I've not heard about that before. So where does the paid leave for all fit into the infrastructure conversation right now that's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. So we often talk about, and you know this well, Kristen, we're at many of these tables together, the care economy or the care infrastructure having three main pillars. I think you could probably even go bigger, but the three main ones being, if you think about the span of our lives and major points of care, it's childcare, it's elder care or long-term services and supports. And then we have to think about paid leave as being the third pillar that has to do with both. And it has to be, it's sort of the glue throughout care, throughout our lives, because at all ends of the spectrum, we're all going to need to give and receive care at some point. And we're all going to need paid leave increasingly more and more as we think about, you know, we talk about the sandwich generation, people having kids and also dealing with aging parents and also just dealing with life, with the unexpected, with pandemics or cancer diagnoses or injuries or whatever it may be, new children. we all just need to realize this is the reality of work, of the economy. It's actually been this way for a long time, but caregivers and women in particular, and women of color in particular, have been kind of just holding us together through sheer will and unsubsidized or undervalued labor. And it's not going to work anymore. And I think the pandemic just made it really clear how, if people didn't get it before, how important and how valuable care is to our economy and to each of our lives, honestly. And I hope if there's one thing we've learned after the last year, it's the value of being there for the people we love and how much touch and presence matters, and the value of it in all kinds of ways, economic and human, and you know. So we are fighting for care infrastructure to really be rebuilt for the first time in this country. We're decades behind the rest of the world. And we think this is the moment to do something transformational and finally pass some real laws.
I love that you brought up we're decades behind other countries. 177 other countries have some form of paid leave available, and the United States of America isn't one of them. The Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell, recently brought up that our lack of a care infrastructure is hurting our economy and harming our world competitiveness, not to mention harming our health. Study after study shows that when you're forced to go to work sick, when you're forced to be in situations that are untenable, that it's actually harmful overall in ways that have rippling impacts. And can you talk about world competitiveness and how we are behind the rest of the world and what that means in the United States of America? I mean, we clearly see, for example, in places where there is access to paid sick days and paid family medical leave in normal flu seasons, 40% less transmission of viruses, right? We're not talking about small amounts of change. We're talking about big. So what's your take on that whole situation?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, this all should be common sense, right? I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. During the pandemic, we had this very limited temporary emergency paid leave law. It was never fully implemented, never advertised really by the Trump administration, but nonetheless, this really, you know, limited program prevented more than 15,000 COVID cases per day. And you're absolutely correct that this applies to the flu. This applies to all kinds of illness, all kinds of medical conditions. And yes, we are one of only two countries in the world that has no form of paid leave at all. And paid leave, we know it is a win-win. It is a support for obviously working families and the workforce. It is a support for employers and small businesses. There's a consistent return on investment for companies that provide paid leave. We know that it makes workers happier, more productive. It makes companies more profitable. There's higher productivity. And so this is something, if we want to kind of carry through into the future of work, we have to have, or we're going to be left behind. And one of my favorite stats right now is that paid leave with other care policies, we have evidence, would yield millions of jobs, billions in wages each year, and trillions in GDP over time. So it's hard to imagine. You know, we talk about sort of economic imperatives and recovery and rebuilding and jobs packages. We can't leave that on the table. Paid leave must pass.
Absolutely. And when we talk about the win-win wins of this policy are so long, you could fill an entire room, maybe buildings, multiple buildings, possibly city, with all the studies showing how great it is. But a couple ones I want to just lift up is that in states, and there are several states that have paid family medical leave, they've passed it at the state level. So we have data. And states with paid family medical leave have a 40% lower need for TANF and for food stamps than if you don't have paid leave. So that's tax dollars saved right there. Also, as you noted, businesses prosper because when we have access to paid family medical leave, it really lifts the burden of the full payment of the person being out off the businesses. So it allows for better competitiveness to happen with smaller businesses, with medium and larger businesses, because people can have more comparative policies instead of, you know, all or nothing. You shouldn't have to win the boss lottery in order to have access to paid family medical leave. And so it allows more companies to actually be able to have paid leave. Well, in fact, all in those jurisdictions where it passes, hopefully the entire country. And right now, also, people who are working in the lowest wages jobs, who have the least amount of flexibility, also have the least access to paid leave. So it's an untenable situation. And as we're talking about this untenable situation, we are in an also simultaneous situation of hope. We're in a situation of change. We can tell that because policies have been marching across the country, passing in cities and states across the country, moving toward the Beltway, that we have momentum growing. And we can tell that because we had our first ever temporary, non-universal, totally not good enough paid family medical leave policy pass and the recovery package, that we are seeing national change. So it's no longer a question of if, but when, but the when needs to be like tomorrow. So what right. can people do to make the when happen sooner?
Here's what you need to do. Contact every single representative you have in Congress, your senators, your congresspeople. You can call them. You can call the switchboard, which is an easy way to find out how to reach them. 202-224-3121. I know Moms Rising also has a text to call, which maybe Kristen, you can plug too. And then we have, I think on all both of our websites, there's action pages. And I know if you go to paidleaveforall.org, click take action, within 10 seconds, you can contact your members. Talk to your neighbors, post on social media, talk to anyone who will listen and say that we need this now. We cannot survive another pandemic or another, frankly, year in this country without this common sense protection for all people. So that would be my plug. And do you know offhand your text to call?
I do. Text the words paid leave to 747-464. Again, paid leave to 747-464. You can do that once a day, people. This is not a limited use opportunity, because the thing that's important is we need members of Congress who are on our side to get fired up and lobby their friends who are members of Congress. And we also need people who are not yet decided to hear from you again and again and again, be that squeaky wheel. And then we need the people who are leaning against doing this to, you know, really hear a lot of uproar. Because here's the deal. When we do polling, and we do a lot of polling, and Dawn does a tremendous amount of spectacular polling in particular, we see that Democrats, Republicans, independents, people of all political persuasions overwhelmingly support paid leave policies, because there is massive proof that this is a win-win-win-win-win-win-win policy area. But our elected leaders in Congress in particular have not caught up to the reality of their Republican and Democratic constituents, knowing that this is an imperative. So you calling again, let's be the squeaky wheel. Let's do it. We have to do it. We need change immediately. The other thing that I want to talk about, when we're talking about unintended consequences, sometimes we're talking about negative consequences. I would like to talk about unintended consequence that is a positive consequence. In the United States of America, being a mom right now is a greater predictor of wage and hiring discrimination than being a woman. And women of color, particularly moms of color, are experiencing compounded wage and hiring discrimination because of structural racism. With moms of color, Latina moms earning as low as 46 cents to a white dad's dollar. This is not a small amount of wage discrimination. But study after study shows that if we pass policies like paid leave, like affordable childcare, like healthcare, and like fair pay policies combined together, that we lower those wage gaps that moms in particular are experiencing, which also in turn lifts our GDP by at least 3% and lifts at least 50% of children out of poverty. This is not a small benefit, a small unintended consequence of the positive kind to of passing paid leave is to help get rid of the gendered wage gaps. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the things I love about this policy is I like to call it, it's sort of a silver bullet solution. There are so many intended, unintended consequences of passing it. To your point, more gender equity, more racial equity, more public health, stronger public health outcomes, families' well-being and security, economic growth. I mean, you name it, paid leave probably helps it. So when people, particularly electeds right now, are thinking about what can I do to really help people in this moment, this is it. And also to your point about the polling, even if you're an elected who doesn't care so much about helping people, which I hope is never the case, but if you just want to hold on to your seat, this is the policy that will do it. It is one of the most widely supported policies in this country. We looked at Senate battlegrounds recently, and 84% of voters support it. That includes 74% of Trump voters. 96% of Democrats. It is overwhelmingly popular with undecideds, independents. There's really no downside. There's no opposition argument. There is no excuse left. This is the year we have to pass it. And this is the summer, as I think Moms Rising has said, the summer of paid leave.
This is the summer of paid leave, people. Thank you so much for being on, Dawn. Thanks for all you do. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Kristen.
We're going to take a quick break, but next up, justice, youth justice, and family justice, and how you can help move forward justice for everyone in the United States of America. We'll be back in just a quick moment.
We're gonna fight for love.
Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rauffing-Finer, powered by Moms Rising. We are joined right now by a spectacular, wonderful, amazing, world-changing, nation-lifting guest who I have the honor of working with, Beatrice Beckford, National Director at Moms Rising. Welcome, Beatrice.
Thanks for having me on, Kristen. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am excited that you're here because we get to talk about a recent victory and give tips on how people can help move forward youth and family justice. And so I want to start with the recent victory. There was a recent victory in Maine where, as a result of people raising their voices, some spectacular things happened. Do you want to share the recent victory?
Yeah, absolutely. So for several years now, we've been collaborating with organizations like Maine Youth Justice, which are largely been led by young people, largely based in Livingston, Maine. And the vast majority of them are North African immigrants. And so they've been leading a campaign that we've been supporting on the parent side to close the last remaining youth prison in Maine. This facility, known as Long Creek, has been notorious for harms against young people, for limiting access to mental health services and resources for vulnerable children who end up there. And unfortunately, in the past, has been cited for several suicides that happened at the facility. Anytime we see anything like that, we know it's not something that we need to have in society and access to children. And so essentially, after years and years of pushing the governor to close this facility and reinvest much of the taxpayer dollars that are wasted on this facility into student supports and supports for young people who are in crisis and beyond, the Maine legislature voted to close the facility and to develop a 2-year plan for transitioning those resources to youth services. So it's a huge, huge win for young people in Maine and a beacon of light for other campaigns that we're working on across the country to close youth prisons in a variety of states. So a fantastic win following the leadership of young people in Maine, and a fantastic win for families as well.
Such an important win. Breaking the school to prison pipeline is so critical, and so is advancing youth justice. We also saw this week in Congress some legislation to help get police out of schools, and I was really excited about that moving in Congress. Can you share our listeners about that and how they can get involved?
Yes, absolutely. So today, actually, Senator Presley, Congressman Presley and Murphy reintroduced the Counseling Not Criminalization Act. It was a spectacular event hosted by the two Congress people and young people and parents in attendance to reintroduce this important piece of legislation that would ultimately end federal dollars to be used for police and schools. And those funds essentially would be reinvested into less punitive and less harmful safety measures in schools. And this includes things like restorative justice programs. This includes things like positive behavior intervention, social emotional learning. It also includes providing additional resources for counselors, nurses, social workers, school psychiatrists, because we know that upwards of 14 million students in America attend schools where there are police officers in their schools, but no social workers, no nurses, no counselors, and no school psychiatrists. And those are the folks that are better equipped to support students who are in crisis, be it behavioral or otherwise, better than police officers can, because they're just not trained to do that.
And when we look at budgets and budgeting, we can see that investments in kids, investments in communities is what really brings safety. I'm going to go back to Maine, bounce back to Maine as an example of how investments can go awry. Maine was spending or is spending $250,000 per year to incarcerate a child and only $13,000 per year to send a child to school. So we invite you to imagine a future where we divest from the carceral system, divest from policing, and invest in care and education, and not just in Maine, and not just with one prison in Maine or youth center in Maine, but all over the place. And we're hoping to see more legislation moving forward nationally as well. And I wondered if you wanted to speak about invest and divest as a framework, and how community safety and reimagining community safety is so critical right now in the United States of America.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you really nailed it. Budgets are essentially moral documents. And so when we see things like what we saw in Maine and what we see in states across the country, right, is this disproportionate investing in prisons and incarcerating and criminalizing young people and families, as opposed to educating them and providing access and opportunity, we're clearly articulating where our values lie. We're clearly operating and funding our fears versus what's possible, right? The power of young people and the power of families and building the capacity for them to thrive. You know, the statistic is in Maine is not so different than in other states. For example, we recently launched in coalition with several other groups in Illinois, the Final Five campaign and an effort to stop an additional youth prison from being there. And in Illinois, we're seeing, you know, the funds that would be used for this facility would essentially amount to about $700,000 per incarcerated young person versus Illinois' education expenditure per child, which is only $15,000. So it nearly blows Maine's numbers out of the water. And that's not what we want to be seeing. We want to be seeing investment, those funds invested in supporting young people, supporting vulnerable children, supporting families with what they really need, which is not more prisons, which is not, you know, flooding communities with police that are not equipped to deal with some of the crises that communities face, and really putting supports and interventions in place. And I'm really glad that you brought up the invest divest, because I think sometimes the biggest pushback is, oh, we don't have the money, you know, for affordable housing. We don't have the money to invest in schools. We don't have the money to make sure that there's mental health facilities for folks who are in crisis. But, you know, the reality is we do have the money and we're using it poorly, right? We're rubber stamping funds into police departments. We're spending millions of dollars to build prisons, when a lot of those resources, if we follow the data and what research tells us, right, which is that prisons are archaic, they are harmful, and they don't make communities safer, they don't make families safer, they don't make children safer, that if we invest in the things that actually do that, that we can radically reimagine what public safety looks like, and we can, you know, provide supports for communities, particularly those who have been divested from and marginalized for far too long. So you're absolutely right. This is a question of how we invest in our communities and in our capacity to thrive as people and build a social safety net and a public, you know, a society that can, you know, be safe and whole and affirming, as opposed to investing in othering and isolating and incarcerating and criminalizing communities, because it hasn't served us and it never really will.
And the other thing that we're investing in when we invest in the current system is structural racism. And that absolutely has to end. Study after study shows that structural racism is through all aspects of our disciplinary systems, everything from school discipline for children who are very young and in preschool, through what's happening in schools when we have more police officers than counselors, through who gets pulled over, through how people are sentenced, through what happens in the prison industrial complex system. There's structural racism embedded through the entire system, which says to every single person who's listening, you need to get involved. Please get involved, and please get involved in a new frame in reimagining community safety, and also imagining a future where we end and get rid of and eradicate structural racism. I wonder what your thoughts are on that aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all interconnected. And, you know, if we really want to talk about racial justice, I think sometimes people think, oh, we should only talk about policing or we should only talk about mass incarceration, which I know you know is not true. I know the team at Moms Rising knows is not true. And I know is not true that all of these issues are deeply intersectional. And when we do the work of racial justice, right, when we do the work to address racial inequities, structural racism, and the inequities that it causes in housing, in childcare, in education, right, in community safety, in economic justice, that we really lift up everybody, right? So if we if we're you know, divesting funds from, you know, of these exorbitant police department budgets, and we invest it in mental health facilities and communities, that helps everybody, right? It prevents further criminalizing in communities that are over-policed, which we know are largely Black and Brown communities. If we divest resources and we invest those into schools, which are too often having to make these draconian cuts, right? But we never make police departments have to make these cuts. That helps everybody, right? Because it creates access to opportunity through education and the school system, right? And if we do this type of invest divest and not see it as, you know, a battle of, you know, law and order, but really an investment in people, an investment in opportunity and access for us all, that essentially is what racial justice is about. It's not just about one community over the other. It's about how we create equity so that we can all thrive. And so, yes, the work of racial justice is deeply intersectional. It works across issues. And when we center that, we're able to make improvements in systemic issues broadly, and we're able to improve the quality of life of all of us. So racial justice helps us all.
We only have a couple minutes left and everybody wants to help. What can people do right now to help?
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely invite folks to visit our Moms Rising website. We have several, specifically to the Counseling Not Criminalization, we've done a recent relaunch of our petition there, and folks can sign on to support that effort. We're also going to be launching Final Five Fridays throughout the summer, which will be the last Friday of every month, where people can call in and help us end the practice of putting kids in cages, end youth incarceration for good. And additionally, to send, you know, this is obviously a very symbolic week with, you know, the president signing into law Juneteenth as a federal holiday. And while that measure is largely symbolic, there's lots of really incredible actions that people can take to support Moms Rising campaigns on childcare, on advancing the infrastructure, on paid family leave, on ensuring, you know, bodily autonomy and reproductive justice and maternal health for us all. And so folks definitely should visit our Moms Rising website and join our petition, our calls and demands for action on a number of issues that impact all of our families.
It's so important. And we're making forward progress, people. We're making progress because people like you who are listening are taking action. They're getting involved. They're staying involved. And on Moms Rising, we have ways for you to get involved, stay involved, and have an impact every day on our website. And if you sign up, it's free. We're your free service to advocacy. We'll reach out to you in those moments when you can make a difference. So you can take, you know, 5 seconds or 5 hours and help make a difference. Is there one thing people should do as we leave them right now? If you have one thing everybody should do?
Yeah, I would say if you can, you know, make yourself a note. I know it's after hours now, but if you can make yourself a reminder, have, you know, your phone set up to do that, and call your congressperson in the morning and tell them how important care infrastructure is, tell them how important it is to ensure that schools are safe, because we are ensuring that they have the resources for student supports and not more cops and criminalizing. Tell them that paid family leave is essential and that we need affordable, accessible childcare for all. There's so many different ways that you can take action on our website, but it's also very easy to pick up the phone and call the people that you put in office and tell them about the things that you care about and share your story as well.
Yes, people want to hear from you. Thank you so much, Beatrice. Thank you for being on. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. Same. Well, that's it for our show today. Thanks so much for tuning in as we tackle the top topics facing our nation in a way that requires the most boring disclaimer in the history of the known universe. Views expressed on this show are those of the individual speakers and should not be attributed to Moms Rising, to this station, or to any news or social media service that may disseminate a recording of this show to the public or to any segment of the public. Boom, we'll catch you next week. We're gonna fight for love.